handle the truth.
The Denise Simon Experience. The Truth Matrix. Vetting, exposing, drilling down to the truth.
Rolling Thunder, this is Hitman, Seattle. Hitman, this is Rolling Thunder, Seattle.
The Denise Simon Experience. Exposing politics, lies, demagoguery, spin, fraud.
Grid to suppress, Mike Charlie 435 9-2-1. Grid to mark, Mike Charlie 473 9-8-9 out.
Promoting individual situational awareness. Question, probe, notice, ask why.
Mark smoke on the deck, two rounds AGBT. TOT 5-3.
And now, the Denise Simon Experience.
Hey there, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Denise Simon Experience. And thanks for so much for being loyal listeners on WDDQ Talk Nanny 2.1. A frequent guest, and it hasn't actually been a while since he's been with us, is Joel Griffith. He is a research fellow of financial regulations for the Thomas A. Rowe Institute of Economic Policy Studies at the Heritage Foundation. Long title, but he's a guru. He's a numbers geek, and we like those kind of people. They make us, we get to surround ourselves with people a lot smarter than ourselves. And we're actually going to talk about employment or unemployment. So, Joel, thanks for carving out some time to join us.
Hey, I really appreciate you having me today.
I'm not trusting these numbers that the government is telling us about employment and unemployment. I think we're being punked. And I'm not sure who is actually getting employed or how they're employed. Can you help straighten us out with some of that?
Yeah, but we've got a lot of numbers that have hit us the last week, including new numbers that came out today in inflation. And my concern isn't so much that the government is giving us inaccurate numbers, it's that so few in the media dive deeper into the numbers to see what they're telling us. And that's why I'm really appreciative that you devote so much time to actually digging deeper on this. So let's start with the big jobs numbers. We see these reported every month. Once again, last month, the official number says more than 200,000 jobs were created. Well, even if we concede that 200,000 jobs are created, there's something that's very troubling underneath the surface. And that's even though the total number of jobs increased last month, according to official data, the total number of full-time jobs actually declined. In fact, we lost 187,000 full-time jobs in February, according to the official government data. And that's just not a one-month anomaly. If you go back over the since March of last year, the official numbers show we've seen 2.5 million jobs added. Well, during that same time frame, in the same data set, it shows that we lost 1.3 million full-time jobs since last March. And so what this really underscores is that we have a surge in part-time jobs. And we have a surge in the number of people who are working not just a full-time job, but also working an additional job to make ends meet. In fact, since Biden took office, we've seen the number of full-time job holders who also have a part-time job increase by 35%. So, you know, given the other numbers that we can talk about in the economy and the cost of living, that shouldn't surprise us that people are having to work multiple jobs to make ends meet.
Well, we see that the credit card debt is exploding and, you know, people are dipping into their 401ks kind of like as their own ATM machine. So that tells you that inflation is killing people across the spectrum such that they've got to go find themselves a part-time job, whatever it may be. It may be 10 hours a week. It may be 25 hours a week. So, I would also say, and help me with this one, Mr. Joel, and that is the actual wage itself. The wages are not keeping up with inflation such that they're actually losing money, the forcing them that second job, yes?
Oh, you're so right. I mean, since Biden took office, the gap between the cost of living and wages has grown. In fact, for a typical two-earner family, real wages adjusted for inflation have actually declined by around $4,000 per family. And that's just using the official inflation numbers. If you dig deeper, once again, the numbers are even worse. And that's for, I would say, two primary reasons. Number one, if you own a house, you know, and especially if you're buying a house, you know that your cost of buying a home has increased far more than the 20-something percent inflation of the past few years. The typical mortgage payment, home insurance costs, and mortgage insurance costs just over the past few years has gone from $1,100 on average to $2,600 on average. That's not 30%. That's closer to 250% increase in the cost of housing. And once again, that full number does not show up in the official inflation rate. Same holds true if you're looking to buy a vehicle. The actual cost of purchasing a vehicle, if you're financing it, hasn't just increased by 20%, which is what the official inflation data shows. If you're financing a vehicle, your payments today on a standard car are about 30% higher than they were a few years ago. And not to belabor the point, but on the family finances side and the credit card debt, you know, we've been hitting consistently new all-time record highs in the amount of credit card debt families have. And the typical family's added around $4,000 of credit card debt the past few years. And the debt servicing for a typical family to pay the interest has gone from $1,300 a year to $2,600 a year. So the official inflation numbers, I'm not saying that they're intentionally skewing the numbers downwards. I believe that many of our statisticians have a lot of integrity, but we have to go a little bit deeper. We have to look at, well, what's it cost to buy a house? What's it cost to buy a home? What's the typical family paying on interest costs on the credit card debt? And if you add all that together, typical families actually have stumbled by far more than just that $4,000 a year decline in income.
Joel, I have the Nextdoor app on my phone. And there's some stupid people on there, by the way, but that's a sidebar. So many people lose their pets, but that's not where I'm going. The one thing that is very common with people complaining on Nextdoor is insurance, both automobile insurance and homeowners insurance, which is pricing people, not that the house itself and the mortgage is pricing them out of the market, but the cost of insurance is pricing them out of the market. And I think that because we have a lack of law and order, that the car insurance has gone up. These insurance companies, they virtually just can't handle the losses that they're taking. And so that's really another piece that really never gets spoken about is the cost of insurance. You know, because these big insurance companies, they're not insuring the lender. I mean, they're not insuring the homeowner, they're insuring the lender. Are you seeing that too, Mr. Joel?
Oh, yeah. And there's been a slew of announcements recently that suggest a lot of insurers are going to be hiking costs by another 20% in the coming year, not just on auto insurance, but also on other forms of insurance, home insurance particularly. On the vehicle side, certainly there is an element of the fact that we do have a number of uninsured drivers, and perhaps many of these are drivers that are not here lawfully, and the penalties in these instances are far too minimal, often to deter motorists from driving without insurance. But the I think the primary component here is just even on the vehicle, the cost of repairing a vehicle has surged alongside all the other inflation rates. So it's not that these insurers are actually seeing bigger profit margins across the board. It's that their cost of doing business has increased substantially. Anecdotally, my insurance, and I don't have any points on my record, no speeding tickets the past 10 years, nothing like that. My insurance has doubled as well the last 3 years. I'm paying $300 a month plus for a Honda Accord, a used Honda Accord, and that's just unfathomable just a few years ago.
Yeah, not to get personal, but my older son was living in Atlanta. They finally got him out 2 years ago, and he had a couple of cars and a couple of motorcycles, three of which had been stolen. And interestingly enough, he moved down here, and his cost of insurance decreased by virtually 50%. So it paid him to actually move here to Florida. You know what I'm saying? We remember back in, 2008, I think it was, when AIG failed. I don't watch this stuff like you do. I'm not an expert at it, but Joel, something tells me that some of these insurance companies, which are really financial operations, there could be some failures here. Is there some truth to that?
Well, I'm very troubled by the housing market in general, yes. Even outside of the possibility of banks failing based on real estate. Our banks have many other problems, as we've seen with the multiple bank failures over the past few years. You had banks that had taken capital and invested in commercial real estate or loaned to commercial real estate. Some of them are struggling immensely. Same holds true with banks that had held money in bonds. And as interest rates rose, the bond prices dropped and drove a number of these banks out of business. With the housing market, what I'm concerned with is that we continue to see the federal government prop up lenders. Yeah. We see the federal government continue to subsidize mortgages. If you look at Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which hold over 90% of all the mortgage-backed securities for residences in this country, those are all government subsidized. And what that has done now, just as it did in 2008, is force up property values. That's why we have seen inflation in real estate exceed inflation overall. And initially, a lot of homeowners were very happy with their home equity balances increasing. But this has created now economic havoc. Home prices have never been, adjusted for inflation, they have never been so unaffordable for American families. If you look at the Federal Reserve Home Affordability Index, in many parts of the country, to just buy a standard middle-class home, it takes you about half of standard income just to get into that property. That is far higher than historical average. And this is a direct result of the government injecting capital into that marketplace. Same holds true with our Federal Reserve. It's just not the money printing they did to finance the government spending. The Federal Reserve printed trillions of dollars to buy up mortgage-backed securities. That inflated home prices even more. And the people that have been hurt the most by these inflated home prices have actually been lower and middle income earners. That is the segment of the housing market that has experienced the highest housing inflation. And these are the individuals now that are least likely to be able to afford a home. Well-intentioned politicians, they handed a lot of money to the banks and real estate developers, and the middle class now is suffering immensely.
So back to the unemployment thing. How many of these people that have now gotten some employment are actually here illegally? Because something tells me that these people that are working here, a lot of them are, since we had this big, huge influx of migrants, that they have gotten a job and they get counted in this number.
Yeah. And I think, as you often, we need to distinguish between those who are here legally and those who are here illegally. If you are here illegally and you're working, well, you have an unfair competitive advantage on those who are here legally, whether as a citizen or as an immigrant. And that's because as an employer, you're obligated to pay, this is just one example, you're obligated to pay payroll taxes and sometimes other types of benefits depending on the state, and that can comprise a significant part of a worker's paycheck. If somebody is here illegally and they're working illegally, well, the person who is employing them, they skirt paying those payroll taxes. So somebody here illegally can market themselves at a rate less than somebody here legally, and they end up pocketing the same amount per hour. So this is a big problem. Second of all, even on these unemployment numbers, we keep hearing these headlines about unemployment being near all-time lows. And it's true, the official unemployment rate has been near decades-long lows, below 4%. Last month it ticked up slightly. But what's not often said is that, well, two things. Well, the unemployment rate itself, you're only counted as unemployed if you're not working but looking for work. if you're not looking for work and you're not working, you're actually not counted as unemployed. So what I like to look at is that labor force participation rate. Labor force participation rate looks at the percentage of the working age population that is actually working or looking for work. And it's a shocking statistic right now. Nearly 2 out of every 5 working age adults are neither working nor looking for work. This is below where it was at prior to the pandemic, and it's substantially below where it was at for decades leading up to the pandemic. In fact, relative to the long-term average from like 1990 to the mid-2000s, the participation rate has declined so steeply that we estimate that this means that close to 6 million people have just disappeared out of the workforce altogether.
You must be blowing a gasket about every day looking at these numbers and seeing how they're trying to sell it to the media and to the entire country. But having said that, when it comes to the actual rate of people getting paid, are these employers looking at their expensive employees and going, you know what, we can't afford you anymore. We can necessarily go hire 2 people cheaper than what we're paying you because you've been with the company 15 years and you're earning at a rate that's, you know, twice as much as is, you know, 2 people. Is there some truth to that? Some layoffs that are happening, and it seems to me that they are the expensive people, especially in Silicon Valley, yes?
Oh, well, these tech layoffs have really been mounting. We've actually been seeing an average of 500 tech layoffs per day over the past 2 years. So it's a big problem in the tech sector overall. But in general, yes, of course, employers are looking to be more efficient and to keep their labor costs down. They have an obligation to do that. They're running your company if they have shareholders or even if they're running it on their own. But once again, it's not as if you see companies seeing their profit margins increase throughout all of this. Their companies are trying to survive right now. In fact, if you look at profit margins, the change in the profit margins during the period of very high inflation we had during the first few years of the Biden presidency, you actually saw company profit margins shrink even as inflation rose, which really shows that a lot of these companies have absorbed a lot of their own price hikes rather than passing them along to consumers. Mm-hmm. These companies are dealing with higher prices for inventory, higher prices for labor, and at the same time, you've seen a decrease in the amount of net profit they're actually bringing in. So I know the Biden administration and the left, they love to blame the price hikes, so they love to play they love to blame the too slow wage growth. They love to blame it on the businesses, when in fact businesses are just trying to deal with the mess that our own government has created.
Well, speaking of that, the one sector that I think gets hurt that nobody really speaks about are those senior citizens that are really living off of Social Security. I'm seeing a lot of senior citizens that are literally going back to work too. Yes?
So with 2 things on this. So number one, there are cost of living increases for Social Security recipients. And that does keep up with the overall rate of inflation. There are some pockets of the country in which for some individuals, those increases in payments have not kept up the localized rate of inflation. I think one way to actually aid those who are retired and who are on Social Security is to fully allow them to work as many hours as they would like to work without penalizing them with benefit reductions.
People are pretty smart, you know. When it comes to money, they work pretty hard at figuring out how to survive. Nobody, I think, is really thriving in some of this unless you happen to be, you know, some of these DEI, you know, people that get hired by these big corporations that are making $500,000 a year. But having said that, there's a massive part of the population that has figured out how to make these adjustments. so they can survive. And I think in a lot of ways, Joel Griffith, this is making our country a sad country because we're not thriving or surviving. Is there truth to that?
Oh, there's a lot of truth to that. I think for many individuals, particularly in the government that have cushy jobs or that are making exorbitant amounts of money within our bureaucracy, there's a disconnect where it perhaps to them, because their income, if you're a government worker, increases along the rate of inflation, they have not experienced this economic pain the way most of us have felt it. But if you're a typical middle class person, and you were already one of the many families, and this is according to Federal Reserve family, most families have under $1,000 worth of savings.
Right.
Well, if you're one of those families and you're entering into this period of high inflation with only $1,000 worth of savings and you've got credit card debt, well, for you, having a $400 a month pay cut, that is substantial. That doesn't mean just giving up your family vacation or giving up the possibility of getting a new big screen TV. It might mean delaying repairing your vehicle to get to work.
Yeah, new tires. Yeah.
Right. It might mean really have to shifting your diet from enjoying comforts to, something just far less palatable. It might mean not being able to really warm your home like you would like to during the winter. This is a real impact on millions of families, and there's a big disconnect. And I think that's why you see these glowing press conferences from the administration. Each time we have these economic releases with these great top line numbers, they're really failing to understand how, when you dig a little bit deeper, it illustrates just how much families are actually feeling the brunt of this right now.
Joel, when it comes to fixing some of this, what disturbs me is there's not a single fix. There's like 300 or 400 or 500 fixes, the things that, regulations, I would argue, or law and order. We need to fix some of that and to help these insurance companies. It kind of defies logic to me that we're in a housing crisis, that we don't have enough housing, and that we've got China that is buying up real estate and they're jacking up prices. And I mean, so the solutions are just kind of across the board, are they not?
Yeah. Well, first, there hasn't been an admission of what actually caused this problem.
Right.
The Biden administration certainly refuses to recognize that what we're experiencing now is a direct result of all the enormous expansion of government. Our government grew by more than 50% during the COVID era and has never shrunk back to its size. And the size was already too large, even prior to that. And that expansion with the money printing and the borrowing directly created the inflation and the economic misery that we are feeling now. And there has been a failure by both leading presidential candidates, for the Republicans and the Democrats, to actually present a plan to get our fiscal house in order. President Trump before has multiple times refused to consider addressing the entitlement spending problem that we have now, which will drive us into insolvency in the coming years. And President Biden's even worse than that. President Biden just unveiled his new budget this week, and it proposes to spend almost $90,000 per family of four in the coming year. Proposes his budget has an average of a $500 billion a year increase just in the interest on the national debt over the coming decade. So this is atrocious. If we don't like what we've experienced the past few years with the temporary explosion of government spending through COVID, imagine what it will be like just a few years from now when we're borrowing and possibly printing at those levels each and every year. If you have an extended period of time in which real family income declines by 3% annually, over time, you're not talking about just a $4,000 decline in real family income. Now we're talking about devastating levels that would push many families into poverty.
Joel Griffith, I'm certainly happy that you could share the truth with us, and that you're so good that you're looking through these numbers and beyond these numbers and telling us what it's really like. Joel, thank you for this.
Thank you, Denise.
Stay the course. Thank you. Come back soon. Ladies and gentlemen,
right,
There's more coming your way. Stay with us.
They are our cuddlers and coworkers, purr machines and love bugs, and constant companions. They are our pets, our family, and they make life so much better. When we face unexpected challenges in life, so do our pets. That's why we're on a mission to support people who love their pets and the pets who love their people, ensuring these families stay exactly where they belong, together. And you have something to offer. With an open heart and mind, there is nothing you can't do. There's no gesture too small or too big when it comes to helping. Whether donating a bag of kibble, sharing an Instagram post of a lost cat, or welcoming a foster pet into your home, every bit of kindness counts. You can help keep pets and people together. Visit petsandpeopletogether.org to learn how to be a helper in your community. This has been a public service announcement brought to you by Maddie's Fund, the Humane Society of the United States, and the Ad Council.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're so pleased that you stayed with us here on the Denise Simon Experience. Somebody that's been on the show previously, but it's actually been a while, and somebody that I follow, maybe I stalk on social media, Michael Pregent. And Michael is a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute. He's a former intelligence officer, a terrorism expert, and he watches all kinds of things, particularly in the Middle East and Iraq and North Africa and so forth. So he's been kind enough to accept the invitation to join us because we need to talk about how things are just, Michael, they're just collapsing everywhere. But welcome back.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
You know, I think I've decided that the definition of terrorism has to be expanded. You know, where we are today is a very different place than where we were. You know, 5 or 6 years ago, even 10 years ago. And I'm beginning to think that, you know, not only has the definition necessarily changed, but I think it's because of necessarily hybrid warfare. Now, stick with me on this one, because I'm going to start off by sideswiping you on this question.
Okay.
Boeing. Almost every day there seems to be a problem with a Boeing aircraft somewhere. And, you know, the first 5 or 6 times I was chucking, you know, the door falls off or a wheel falls off or one slides off the runway, I was beginning to think that it isn't always Boeing. It's a lot of times the maintenance people. But now we have another one out of Australia, I think, where 50 people were injured mid-flight. I'm beginning to think there's some sabotage going on here. Another kind of form of terrorism. What say you?
I've always been taught to think like the enemy. You know, we were always challenged to think like the enemy. So what would you do in order to disrupt commerce? What would you do in order to destabilize democracy? You know, what would you do as an enemy? And I don't have this on my radar yet, but as these things start to happen, it's okay to critically think about what an enemy would do. And then you also have to think about, you know, what's most likely and what's most dangerous. What's most likely is shortcuts were taken. What's the most dangerous thing is our adversaries are learning how to disrupt confidence and shake our, disrupt commerce and shake our confidence in our, you know, in domestic travel and international travel. So there's an advantage there. So that, you know, again, looking at it as an enemy, you know, you can see some possibilities. But again, that's the most dangerous course of action. That's the wild card. You know, how could you use this to your advantage?
Well, you know, China's certainly been doing this kind of stuff, interrupting and putting fear in all kinds of shipping and commerce in the South China Sea. With some success, I might add. You know, they got fishing boats that, you know, are full of spies, and they're, you know, they're challenging Coast Guard operations and that kind of thing. Then we have what's going on in the Middle East with the Houthis. And then we have this Boeing thing. So I think we have a trifecta of a situation here. And maybe I'm putting too much into it, but I'm not liking it.
Yeah, so, you know, let's talk about what China's doing. Let's talk about terrorism. You know, I'm looking at the United States now through a lens of a foreign intelligence officer. Like, what would I, when I see how the United States is reacting to China, how it's afraid to punish Iran for the actions of the Houthis, how it's afraid to sanction Turkey and other allies for buying Iranian oil despite U.S. sanctions, you have to feel very comforted by the lack of a strong position by this administration on pretty much anything. And so it gives our adversaries advantage. So I just said that I'm starting to look at the United States through the lens of a foreign intelligence officer. And what I'm seeing, and I'd really like to talk about the border, because China's there, right, with fentanyl. Mm-hmm. China's working with the cartels. Mm-hmm. The cartels are working with terrorist organizations. Mm-hmm. Terrorist organizations are bringing in skilled military age males into the country. You know, all they have to do is get two men in every 5,000 man wave, right? Mm-hmm. You see the media basically say, you know, what's wrong with these Republicans for not supporting this bipartisan border bill? And the easiest answer is because it allows a brigade size element to come into the United States every day. And what your listeners need to know is a brigade size element is roughly 5,000 military age fighting men. And again, to be successful as a terrorist organization, you just need to get 10 guys in over 3 months that can do very bad things. And that's what I'm worried about now. And when it comes to, you know, October 7th, right, in this post-October 7th world, we now have Americans who are protesting against the U.S. ally mm-hmm. for going after a terrorist organization that killed 30 Americans. And this administration won't even say that they killed 30 Americans, but they have American hostages. We don't see their names on the chyrons of our news screens. We don't know who they are. I mean, you can find out who they are if you do a deep dive, but we shouldn't be doing a deep dive mm-hmm. on finding out the names of the Americans who were killed by Hamas. But here's where I'm concerned. So if I'm, I've been taught to think like the enemy, think like a terrorist. So if I'm a terrorist, I now see an America where, hey, because of China, because of TikTok, you get all these idiot Americans in this woke movement believing that Osama bin Laden's letter to America made sense. Wow, he actually has some good points here, right? We saw the TikTok videos of dumbass Americans, excuse my language, saying that Osama bin Laden had a point. And if I'm a terrorist leader, I'm literally thinking to myself, not only can I get in skilled fighters into the United States, but I may actually have 30% of the population support what we're doing if we conduct a high-profile attack. This is a very, very dangerous world we're living in right now, and there are solutions. Now, I'm a solution-based guy. There are solutions to our problems. And a lot of it has to do with protecting the border. And the other part of it is allowing law enforcement to go after these violent military-aged males that are part of these protest movements. And for some reason, they believe they're a protected class. And I shouldn't say for some reason. It's because law enforcement isn't going after them. That's because DAs aren't going after them. That's why all these things are happening. You know? It doesn't make any sense, but the solutions are right there in front of us. But those are the things I'm concerned about, because everything you're talking about, if Americans are afraid to fly, if Americans are afraid to travel, mm-hmm. if China's able to disrupt the U.S. economy by basically not telling the Houthis to stop in the Red Sea. Remember, a lot of those vessels are being flagged with Russian flags and Chinese flags, mm-hmm. and the only way the Houthis can accurately target vessels is with the help of the Iranians. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned these fishing ships, right? So the Iranians have these two big vessels in the Red Sea and one in the Gulf of Aden. One's called the Saviz and the other one is called the Beshad. their intelligence collection and targeting platforms. They are the reason the Houthis are accurate in their strikes. The United States should take them out. The United States is not. If we took those two ships out, the Houthis would likely be targeting flagged Russian and Chinese ships because they wouldn't know who to hit. And there are so many easy things we can do. This administration is just choosing not to sit on its hands. And I would say, you know, hey, Biden administration, why don't you treat terrorists and treat our adversaries like you treat Republicans, like you treat Texans, like you treat America? And then maybe we'd have some solutions.
Touche. Yeah, let's go back to these Iranian spy ships. And I would argue, you know, we lost two Navy SEALs maybe about a month ago now because they were attempting to board a vessel to
smuggling weapons. Yeah, they're smuggling Iranian weapons to the Houthis. Yes.
Yes. So because of that operation, and it never said whether it was successful or it failed, but I would say we have got some amazing technology. You know this much better than I do because of your resume. We know precisely, you know, how these missiles are getting to the Houthis. We know precisely how North Korea is delivering weapons to Russia. What are we doing here? I mean, if for nothing else, we could stop some of that. But on top of that, we could be using electronic warfare, which is really kind of a simple thing to do, is it not, Michael?
Yeah, we could jam those platforms, and I think we've jammed them a couple times already. And that's why they actually hit some ships they weren't supposed to hit. But we can also take them out. There's a lot of things we can do, from drone technology to electronic countermeasures. This administration is just hell-bent on somehow believing that if they set an adversary down for 2 hours, that adversary would vote Democrat at the end of the day.
Right.
Matter of fact, they're already voting Democrat because they know that Democrat administrations allow them this green light to, you know, this green light to commit chaotic events. You know, it's a permissive environment when a Democrat is in office when it comes to national security and foreign policy. And I don't mean to sound like a partisan when I say that, but when did Iran become a partisan issue? It used to be that the Islamic Republic of Iran was despised by Republicans and Democrats. And now it seems like the Democrat Party is somehow pro-Iran, and then the media will tell Americans that the Republican Party is somehow pro-Russia, when I don't believe that's true at all.
No,
I just think we have exhaustion in this country where Americans are tired of these forever wars that we continue to lose.
Well, we're only in forever wars because they keep changing the rules of engagement and have pity on the enemy. You know, it's kind of like we could have solved the Russia-Ukraine thing going all the way back to the Obama administration, and they didn't do it. It could have necessarily been solved in the Trump administration and didn't do it, although at least he gave him Javelin missiles as opposed to MREs and blankets. But now we have a new situation here, and I'm just waiting for the shoe to drop, and that's Haiti. Haiti's got no functioning government, none, zero. And, you know, you've got these gangs that have pretty much blown up the entire little country. But those gangs have not been operating just here in the last week or 2 weeks. They have been operating for years. So it's and the United Nations actually has a physical presence and has had a physical presence in Haiti. So there's a humanitarian crisis that's going on. And so you mentioned our southern border. Well, now we're going to have a whole, you know, are we going to do an airdrop and then start flying people out of Haiti? Like
wasn't there an evacuation order of non-essential personnel from Haiti? Yeah, I mean, lawlessness is now the pervasive environment in a lot of countries. You know, there are protected classes. In the U.S., you know, one of the biggest complaints in Chicago and New York is that they keep arresting the same people. But we see this this influx, right? And then they'll be protected. So let's say we get a migrant crisis. You know, the Democrats will always talk about how they're fleeing, you know, an environmental issue or, mm-hmm. or a corrupt government and mm-hmm. they're you know,
crime.
There's all these things. But, you know, I mean, Haiti, if all we had to do is worry about Haiti, that would be a nice world. Unfortunately, we have to worry about everything else, too. And gone are the days where we could just focus on foreign threats. The foreign threats are here now. This open border crisis, again, if you want to sneak in some people, it's easy to do. And these terrorist organizations are when I say recruiting the talent, they're recruiting the talent from non-Arab looking military age males. So they're going to go after Latinos. They're going to go after brown and black people to attack Americans. So they have that degree of separation. It's just the Al-Qaeda had a playbook to do that too. We captured documents in Iraq where Al-Qaeda said, come in through the Texas-Mexican border, learn Spanish and pretend you're a Latino. Mm-hmm. But our Border Patrol agents can, our Border Patrol agents know who they are because our Border Patrol agents are great Americans who, and many of them are Mexican-American. I have relatives in my family that are Mexican-American. My mom married into a Mexican family when I was 4 years old. And I have relatives in the Border Patrol that will tell me all the time, yeah, we keep catching these Arabs coming across and they try to pretend they're Latino and we can call them out. Yeah, there's a lot of things our adversaries can do now. And we have this environment where, you know, 30% of the population feels sorry for anyone who happens to be someone who crossed the border. You know, you saw the president have to walk back his comments.
Yeah. He didn't have to. He wanted
calling
to.
Calling a killer, you know, this guy's a murderer. Instead of just simply calling him a murderer who crossed the border illegally, he's now saying, well, he's what is he, unregistered alien or unregistered?
Undocumented, yeah.
Undocumented, yeah. It's like, you know, when you use terms like that, again, you tell our enemies, hey, it's green light chaos. You can do whatever you want. It's a permissive environment in the U.S. because the Democrats are terrified to go after anyone who is in a protected class that they put in that, you know, protected class. Sorry to be redundant.
No,
they created a protected class, and now they're afraid to deal with it, and our adversaries are taking advantage of it.
In your opinion, why does it take the United States so long to, one, admit that there's a problem, and two, to decide to do something about it or not do something about it?
Well, we have that not in my backyard syndrome, right? Where as long as it doesn't touch them, they don't worry about it. And that's why I thought it was incredible that DeSantis and Abbott sent all these, you know, illegal migrants to Chicago, LA, and New York, all these places so they could feel the pain, Washington, D.C. And now we have New York like, hey, we can't do this. We're no longer a sanctuary city. You know, we've got National Guard in the subways to protect against these criminal gangs from Venezuela and El Salvador. And, you know, it's only when they feel the pain do they react. And it's sometimes it's hard for them to feel the pain. We even have these gated community, high-level Democrats still denying that there's an issue. I mean, Nancy Pelosi doesn't think there's any problems out there because she's immune from all of it.
Mm-hmm.
Except when her husband allows a stranger in the middle of the night. You know? Anyway.
If you were going to write a intelligence briefing and sit before the Senate Intelligence Committee, what would you include in that?
I would say we have terrorist cells in the United States already operating. Qatar is funding a lot of the Muslim Brotherhood entities from CARE to others. They're fueling these protests here in the United States. They're funding Hamas. But Hamas isn't the only problem. We have ISIS, potential ISIS cells, mm-hmm. because, you know, okay. ISIS built an incredible brand where anybody who commits a terrorist attack could be called a lone wolf and pledge allegiance to ISIS. We have Al-Qaeda cells. We have Lebanese Hezbollah cells. And, you know, we saw that warning from the FBI and local law enforcement in California, warning about these terrorist organizations that are coming across. The FBI director has said it as well. The issue is, if you listen to what Secretary Austin says and what Biden says, they don't think they're the threat. They think veterans who are pro-Second Amendment and vote Republican are the threat. And so I would, what I would say is, listen, we have to focus on our actual, the actual threats in this country and not political threats. Because we're getting to a place now where this administration is more focused on American citizens who vote Republican than on non-citizens who threaten democracy.
You know, I remember, I think his name was Patrick Wood, who was one of the people at the State Department that was testifying during all things Benghazi. And I remember he being asked one particular question, and his answer was, the Taliban is in the building. And I've not forgotten that, because I feel like now all kinds of groups that are just like the Taliban are in our buildings. And that includes China. And they've been here in our institutions, both government and non-government, and in university. And we've got gangs. And I would argue that not only do we have these Chinese military age men coming across our southern border, but I also think they are gang members, Chinese gangs. And then we have those from Venezuela. And so... The Taliban, his definition of during the Benghazi hearings is one thing, but we're in a different place now where it's everywhere. And like Christopher Wray or not, I think he's really sounding the alarms here, but is anybody really listening to him, do you think?
Well, you know, there's the difference between a soundbite and actual action behind the scenes in the FBI are two different things. I mean, I know local law enforcement and the FBI and the intelligence community are overwhelmed by the number of threats, yet this administration continues to have them look at political opponents and Americans as the bigger threat than actual adversaries. And I hate to sound like an alarmist, but again, I'm looking at the United States through the lens of what a foreign intelligence officer who is hostile to the U.S. would look at the U.S., how they would look at the U.S. And you literally have a law enforcement apparatus that is not capable of protecting cities, is not capable of putting down protests, would probably not be capable of dealing with an actual terrorist threat. And what I mean by that is preventing one based on, you know, an intelligence heads up that something was coming. And now you have, you know, I'm not kidding. If an FBI task force is set up to go after the jihadists within these pro-Hamas protests, you would have somebody at the table say, what are you doing? Why aren't you focusing on those people? And those people would be Republicans. Those people would be pro-Second Amendment, pro-First Amendment Americans. And we're letting DEI people inside of the intelligence briefings and the task force creation saying, hey, we're not going to allocate our, you know, we're not going to increase our budget to tackle these issues because you're going after people of color.
Yeah.
And that's what they call a jihadist now, a person of color.
I'm like, no.
The thing is, you know, what I love about learning Arabic and spending a lot of time working with Muslims to go after terrorist groups is no one can call me an Islamophobe. So I can call it like I see it. And I have the credentials to back it up. But when somebody basically says you're an Islamophobe because you're anti-Hamas, Americans should not be afraid of that tag. Don't be afraid of that. The tag of Islamophobe has worn out. It doesn't work anymore. The tag of racist is laughable at this point because they've made everything racist to the point where it doesn't even hurt anyone anymore. It only hurts the alarmist that is using the phrase. It only diminishes their credibility when they use stupid terms like, you know, you're Islamophobic or you're a racist. No, I'm looking at bad people through their actions, and you're looking at them simply as
social
what color they are, or what their race is. Just look at their actions. And when I say their actions, I mean the people that are one degree away from violence in these protests.
I've seen you, you know, do interviews on with foreign media, and I'm glad for that. Would you be having the same conversation if you were invited by the BBC today that you're having with me?
Yeah, they asked these questions. I was on France 24 after January 6th, and they were so worried that when Biden was going to do his inauguration speech that Americans were going to storm the Capitol. And I said, they're not going to do that. He goes, why? Why not? I go, because that's not what this is. This is, there is no group that's ready to take over the U.S. government. So I say it like it is. I've always been happy to say it like it is. I tell decision makers what they need to know, not what they want to hear. And I say it like it is based on my background and my credentials in the counterterrorism space.
Well, we're full. We have, I think the military calls it ungoverned space. And I see that manifesting in a big way. You know, you mentioned Turkey earlier. I think Erdogan himself is perpetuating ungoverned space. I think we've got a lot of ungoverned space in Africa, mostly because of the Wagner group that's operating in places in Africa, but also because of China. So I would argue somewhere between North Korea, Iran, Russia, and China, they're all collaborating against the West, not just the United States. Is that a true statement?
Yeah, I mean, this is the last months before a major U.S. election. This is where our adversaries get all they can. We're seeing Russia try to get all they can in Ukraine. We're seeing Iran, through its proxies, try to get all they can in the Middle East and North Africa. And China's already winning. No, China can win through their economy, through their predatory lending to countries, through their courtship of our allies. And then because we waver with our allies are hedging their bets. We have traditional allies in the Middle East that are now leaning towards Russia and China because they feel abandoned by this administration. And they'll come back if there's a Republican administration, but then they'll also be prepared to pivot again. So everybody's taking advantage of these things. And remember, in ungoverned spaces, that's where ISIS that's where ISIS mm-hmm. grew. Mm-hmm. That's where Al-Qaeda operates. That's where we have these ungoverned spaces in the United States because our law enforcement can't handle threats. They're told not to handle threats, only certain threats. So those violent pro-Hamas protesters that stopped the president from getting to the State of the Union, they weren't arrested, they weren't detained, they weren't cleared out. But had they been waving American flags, had they been Republicans, had they been Texans, they would have been arrested. And that's an issue. We have a protected class in this country that our adversary is going to take advantage of, and they're going to simply recruit the talent. And when I say the talent, the most violent in the group, the military age men that are one degree away from violence and hate this country, because that's what I would do.
Well, I'm happy that you say it like it is. I keep also going over in my mind over the horizon. And, you know, whatever that is, I don't think that we're using it because I think that, Afghanistan's going to rear its ugly head in a big way with what is happening there. I think it's manifesting itself. And we got, we have over the horizon abilities right here in the United States, but the Department of Justice is suing Texas and suing Governor Abbott. So, Michael Pregent, thanks for sharing some time with us and putting us all in context, certainly with your expertise, thinking like the enemy. So I appreciate that. I'm going to have to maybe adjust some of my thinking too, to see if I can't equal or somewhat stalk you some more mentally. So thank you for that. We appreciate your time with us, and I hope you'll come back soon.
No, thanks for having me. Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me. You always come up with some great wild cards, and they are important.
They are
important because you got to think about all these things. All right. Thanks a lot for having me.
Ladies and gentlemen, there's more coming your way. Stay with me.
the conversation starter. This is Talk 92.1 WDDQ 8L Valdosta.